not have a quorum, but we're going to start with the first bill anyways. And once we get a quorum, we will go back to move the bill. So can I have Representative Richardson to the testify table? We'll start with House File 3079. Members, we have a DE office amendment that we are unable to move right now, but I would like for Representative Richardson to maybe explain your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. So House File 3079 seeks to expand the scope of the legislation Minnesota passed in 2001 to address the persistent and growing problem of health disparities between the white population and people of color and indigenous populations. Although Minnesota is one of the healthiest states in America, it has some of the greatest health disparities between race and ethnic groups. In order to address these disparities, the Minnesota Department of Health was charged with working with impacted communities through the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, which provides grants and empowers community-based organizations to help develop health improvement strategies centered on cultural and community strengths with a goal that community members will be more likely to be reached, engaged, and impacted. It's become clear that one area where there's additional opportunity to work with the community to develop strategies to move the needle on reducing health disparities is on the intersection of race and disability. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the data shows that 3 in 10 American Indians have a disability and 1 in 4 African Americans have a disability. We know there are unacceptable disparities for indigenous communities and for communities of color in Minnesota. And it's also important to note that there are some unique challenges and barriers that can come with addressing disparities within the disability community. Growing up with siblings with disabilities, I've seen those challenges. House File 3079 would simply require the department to work to address health disparities experienced by individuals with disabilities and would require the community grant program, which invests about $5 million annually, to also include this focus. Today, I'm also joined by Advocate Noah McCourt, who is here to testify in favor of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Noah McCourt, and I'm an autism advocate. I wanted to thank you for allowing me the time to testify today in support of House File 3079. As you are undoubtedly aware, there has been extensive research at the federal and state health agencies in regards to access and to both the access and the quality of health care amongst racial and ethnic minorities. While the research has documented many disparities, there continues to be indications that these disparities are even greater amongst individuals who not only are people of color, but also have disabilities. Disability, especially complex disability, is more common in many racial and ethnic minority groups than it is among other populations, including non-Hispanic whites. The combination of disability with membership in a minority racial or ethnic group is associated with less access to the social determinants of health, i.e. education, employment, and income, than belonging to either group alone. Yet little work has been done to specifically examine the intersection of race, ethnicity, and disability in relation to healthcare access and utilization. I think it's particularly notable that the Centers for Disease Control show that the state of Minnesota has the second highest prevalence rate of autism spectrum disorder in the country. In Minnesota, 1 in 42 of Minnesota's children is on the autism spectrum. These rates are significantly higher in both the Hmong and Somali communities. In the East African community, it's about 1 in 32. This morning, I testified in the State Government Operations Committee on legislation that would designate April 2nd as Autism Awareness and Acceptance Day here in Minnesota. It's my hope that the passage of that legislation will not merely serve as another platitude, but also as a call to action that Minnesotans with disabilities, particularly those of us of color, ought to be included in these types of statewide initiatives because we continue to face significant gaps in healthcare services and healthcare access. The proposed legislation will address this gap that is often overlooked and or underrepresented. In conclusion, members, House File 3079 allows for bridge building between underrepresented communities, and it allows us to move the ball forward on advancing initiatives to eliminate to continue eliminating disparities in access to care and the receipt of recommended preventative care services. I urge you to support the passage of House File 3079.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. More importantly, thank you for your advocacy. Really appreciate your leadership for the disability community and autism. So, members, do we have any questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify in support for or in opposition of House File 3079? So, okay, we are one short of a quorum. So, can you please just stay in the room and we'll recall you when we get a quorum? Well, there we go. Representative Robbins, you've just made our quorum.
Happy to be an help man.
So, before we go any further, since we have a quorum, may I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved.
So moved. So, Representative Schultz have moved the minutes for February the 28th. 2020. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? The minutes move. Okay. So the chair moves that House File 3079 be recommended for placement on the general register. Representative Richardson, you do have an office of minutes, so and it's in your folders. So the chair moves the DE1 office amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and Representative Richardson, all three amendments have been moved. Since there's no further discussions, the chair renews her motion that House File 3079 as amended be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
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 All opposed? House File 3779 as amended is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we're going to move on to House File 3318, Representative Akam. Welcome to the committee, Representative Akam. Before you begin your testimony, I just want, since we have a quorum, I just want to share with members what today looks like. So we do have a really long agenda today, and we're going to try to get through the first six bills before we recess. So we're going to keep going until around 4:15, until 4:15. To finish a portion of the agenda. Then we will recess until about 6 o'clock when we will reconvene in room 120 in the Capitol to finish our business for the day. I know I have voted already. I got up really early to go vote before I came here, but that would be also an opportunity for those who want to vote and have not voted to go vote in your polling place. So to that, Representative Akam, the chair moves that House File 3318 be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Division. Representative Akam, we have delete all author amendment in our folders. In the pages has also handed out an amendment to the amendment, I believe. So the chair moves the DE2 author's amendment And then I will also move the A1 amendment to the amendments. So do we all have a copy of the amendment to the amendments? It's the A1. Amendments, are there any discussions on the amendments? Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 Of the A1 amendments? All opposed? The motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. So now the chair renews her motion to adopt the DE2 author's amendment as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and the DE2 amendment as amended is adopted. Representative Acom, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm before you today to discuss House File 3318. This bill modifies the housing support program known as Metro Demo by modifying an existing exception to the moratorium on the development of new housing support beds. Metro Demo was a demonstration project created in 1995 in housing support, formerly GRH. This expansion would create the resources immediately to provide needed housing connected to services for single adults and families. This bill is a partnership and combination of Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative, Dakota County, and the Minnesota Inter-County Association, also known as MICA. Both were coming forward with similar proposals to increase the Metro Demo, and with the approved amendment, we have combined the proposals into one bill. What the bill does, it increases the Metro Demo from 226 units to 650 units. It increases the Metro Demo to the entire 7-county metro, adding Scott, Carver, and Washington counties. It directs 146 of the units to be for supportive housing for families in Scott and Hennepin counties. And it updates the language to reflect the current uses of the program. And with that, I want to turn it over to a couple of testifiers, Madeline Kassler from Dakota County, who will explain the expansion of the program and the strikeouts in the bill.
Well, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Madeline Kassler. I'm with Dakota County Social Services. In partnership with the 7-County Metro Area, Minnesota Inter-County Association, or MICA, and Beacon, Dakota County has proposed an expansion of the Metro Demo project to more immediately and effectively provide housing for people experiencing homelessness. As you know, there is a focused effort to end homelessness at all levels of government. While the problem seems daunting, the solutions are straightforward. People need a place to live, a way to pay for that place, and support services. Rental assistance, a key way to pay for a rental unit, is a particularly scarce resource. The proposed expansion of Metro Demo is a unique way to quickly expand access to rental assistance and support services together. The demo project mimics traditional rental assistance with a person paying 30% of their income toward rent. Those who qualify can transition onto housing choice vouchers or Section 8 or other traditional resources when those become available while retaining their services. When someone transitions onto another resource, the vacated demo spot can then be recycled to a new person. The metro area counties will jointly manage these resources and funnel them to places where our system is stuck. In a recent analysis, the metro area counties identified 848 households, both families and single adults, who were unhoused and qualified for Metro Demo. We recognize that this is a significant undercount of actual need, and also recognize that we're not trying to solve for the whole of homelessness with this proposal. Metro Demo is one piece of a puzzle, and the request to increase demo spots by 424 reflects this balance. Additionally, we are proposing to strike some language that prescribes the specific population served. By doing this, the Metro resource maintains flexibility to serve people without housing generally, rather than narrowing the resource to a subset of this population. As other resources grow and shrink, and as the housing market changes, it's important to have a resource that can flex to fill gaps and meet needs more immediately. The remainder of the strikeout language provides alignment with the broader housing support program and cleans up some obsolete language. Thank you very much for your time and consideration. And now Helvick Anderson will address the need for permanent supportive housing for families.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ben Helvick Anderson, and I am the Public Policy Director at Beacon Interfaith Housing Collaborative. Beacon is a collaboration of over 100 congregations united in building homes, sheltering families, and advocating so that all may have a home. Beacon has created 19 buildings across the metro that provide 600 homes, most of which is supportive housing. That is housing with supportive services right in the building for folks who are moving or have experienced homelessness. We also run a family shelter program in congregations, which is an overflow shelter for Hennepin County and the only family shelter for Scott and Carver County. I will speak directly to the point that directs units specifically for family supportive housing. As I stated in my introduction, Beacon has emerged as a leader in building supportive housing, and we run in partnership with our collaboration of congregations, a shelter program for families who are homeless. We know through this work there is a lack of supportive housing specifically for families. Very little of it exists. Often the only option for folks exiting homelessness who have a family is geared towards single adults, not allowing their family to stay together. This lack of supportive housing for families is because of a lack of public funding for the higher rent rates that families require. The standard housing support program, which Metro Demo exists inside of, that rent rate is capped at $922 a month, which is not enough to pay for a 2-, 3-, or 4- bedroom apartment that a family requires. The Metro Demo is unique because it utilizes a rent rate connected to the fair market rate calculated by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development. This allows for a housing support rent rate to match the size of the unit, thus accommodating larger apartments for families. Some of the current demo units are being utilized for this purpose to great effect, and directing 146 of the demo units towards supportive housing for families will allow the development of this needed resource that is lacking in the continuum of housing and support. Expanding the demo for supportive housing for families is the most cost-effective and strategic way to leverage resources and create this needed asset. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3318? Okay, we're opening up for questions. I think I have a question for you. I just want to thank you for the work that you do around housing. Looking at affordable housing and increasing that capacity for the homeless. I'm just wondering, do you do any work in Ramsey County, St. Paul?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, we have Prior Crossing, which is a supportive housing development for youth, which is located on University and Prior Avenue in St. Paul.
Well, I appreciate that, because I didn't hear you mention Ramsey County. But also, I would think that, you know, Ramsey County may have some of the worst housing disparities, too. And so the more work we can do to support Ramsey County would be appreciated as we look for affordable housing. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed that in the delete all, or in the now the amended version of the bill, that a number of provisions are struck in this at the top of page 2, and some of it makes sense. There's one that expires in 1997, but I guess the one that jumped out at me was the sentence beginning line 2.4, that in current law requires at least 70% of the supportive housing units to serve a certain subset of particularly vulnerable homeless adults. And I noticed that that's been removed, and I'm sorry if I missed that in your explanation of the bill, but if you can just maybe just remind us of what the rationale is for lifting that, removing that sentence.
Okay, Ms. Kastner?
Madam Chair, Representative, members of the committee, our goal with striking that language is to create a flexible resource in order to target this resource to populations in the homeless community that are being underserved, and that need can change over time. So being prescriptive in the statute language, we didn't feel served us to be able to be as nimble as we would like to be in trying to target resources to the population experiencing homelessness in general. Oftentimes resources are specific for specific populations, and then you see a ballooning of homelessness within another population. So our goal is to be as flexible with this population so we can fill those gaps when they pop up in the system.
Representative Clinton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I just want to clarify then that in addition to the other changes, like you've got the references here, it says update the statute language to reflect current uses of the program. It sounds like there's a little bit more than that in terms of wanting to alter some of the current requirements to provide more flexibility for the funds, which makes total sense to me. I just want to make sure that that's kind of an additional goal that's weaved in here, because it won't just be the 400 plus new units. It's the original 226 units that now can be provided to a broader set of homeless adults, and not just the ones that are specified here, mental illness, substance abuse problems, and HIV, et cetera. Is that right?
Correct, Madam Chair, Representative. I would say, though, that there's a high level of stability with the people who are currently receiving this resource. So on average, people are housed for 7.1 years when receiving this resource. So we don't anticipate, unless people move on to more traditional rental assistance resource, we don't anticipate a lot of turnover.
Okay. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I wanted to follow up on Representative Pinto's question, particularly in 2.2 and 3, where you strike people discharged from a regional treatment center, community hospital, or residential treatment program. And then in the section referenced by Representative Pinto, it also talks about people in residential chemical dependency treatment. I served many years ago on the state's chronic homelessness task force. And clearly the link between chemical dependency and mental health and homelessness is robust. And so it's concerning to me that striking any reference to that population will have unintended consequences of limiting their access when really they really need to be, if not first in line, very close to first in line.
Mrs. Kassler.
Madam Chair, Representative. Our intention by striking that language is not to exclude people, but to be inclusive. When we do our analysis on where to target resources, we're looking at where people are not able to access housing resources. And so if our analysis looks, if our analysis shows that people exiting institutions are having a hard time accessing housing resources, we can funnel our resources in that way. And in fact, we do, as a metro area, we do manage a broader housing support project, and through some analysis saw that people exiting institutions were not being served through our traditional services, through our traditional access points. And so we have funneled are a subset of housing support resources to that very population because we did see a need.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick follow-up on line 1.21. It says for the family units that they are for a provider located in Hennepin County providing site-based permanent supportive housing. Do you have a provider already designated, or who is that referencing?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, so this is referencing the development of two supportive housing units for families happening that Beacon is building in Hennepin County.
Thank you. All right. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Moran. So my question is this funding for new units, new beds that are being developed, or any being converted?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative, you're referring to the units for family supportive housing?
Mm-hmm.
Those are for new ones being developed.
Representative Schultz.
So has this bill been in front of the Housing Committee, and is it in front of Health and Human Services because of the supportive services, that are the wraparound services for the housing units? I mean, is some of this money being used for the services or just to develop the housing units?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair and Representative, so those buildings will use bonding dollars, hopefully, and that will pay for the development and the capital costs. We also need service funding to be able, and this pays for the rents of the residents, the families to be housed there. So that's what this is for out of housing support, is the operating costs of the building.
Okay, Representative New. Representative Stewart, are you? Okay. Representative New?
Pass.
Oh, passed. Okay, is there any further discussion? Okay, so there being no further discussion, the chair renews her motion that House File 3318, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 3318, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee.
Thank you, ma'am.
So, member, the testifiers for my bill today are from Bemidji and Alexandria. So I'm going to present my bill next so that they can get on the road to head home. So we change a little bit.
Chair Moran, welcome to the testifiers table.
Thank you.
Would you like to move your bill and then proceed with your presentation?
Yes, Chair Morrison. I move that House File 3632 be recommended for placement on the general register.
Please proceed.
Okay. So, members, before you, we have the Family Asset for Independence in Minnesota, which I'm going to reference the FAME bill. The purpose of the FAME bill is to help low-income working Minnesotans increase saving assets and financial knowledge to achieve greater economic security. The FAME program is a match saving program. So what happens is that So for every $40 that you save, the federal government would give you three times that amount in savings, so that you can use those savings to purchase a home for down payment, to start a small business, and or to pay for college. All right, good. FAME participants, oh, so I just explained it pretty well. So for me, this bill is like personal. And I'm always sharing my personal life stories, you guys, so I'm gonna open up and share again. Because many of you know that I'm a mother of seven, and when me and my family came to Minnesota, we spent the time then homeless. So part of that, when I finally was able to get housing, part of what I knew I wanted to do as a mother saving, I thought about college, I thought about, you know, what those next steps, but for sure I knew I needed to save some money. And I came across this program called FAME through Community Action Partnership, which I was able to save $40. And I think I did that over a two or three year time period. And when I had an opportunity to buy a home 5 years later, I had this money that I had saved up that I can use for my down payment for my home. But I also had a son in college that I also utilized some of these dollars to pay for books, right, that are truly unaffordable. So it's a really great program to utilize, but what has happened is that the federal government has decided not to support this program any longer. And so that's where we are. It has been said that it takes income to get by, but it also takes assets to get ahead. Since the year of 2000, FAME graduates have acquired over 2,400 assets, including purchasing homes, using the dollars towards higher education degrees and to successfully start a small business. So as I said again, the Minnesota FAME program is threatened because of the elimination of the federal funding. This bill would allow existing state FAME appropriations to be used to match participants' personal savings without requiring the secondary funding match. Now that federal funding is no longer available, this will make sure that we have participants who are still able to utilize the savings, continue to save, and do that without the barrier of having or that been taken away because of the federal funding that is no longer available for these participants. So I have some testifiers today who traveled a distance. You know, this is a statewide program, and today they're going to share why we need this legislation moved.
Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your opportunity to testify today. My name is Kelly Minerat, and I am with West Central Minnesota Communities Action in Elbow Lake, Minnesota. I started at Community Action as an assistant in Head Start, was able to enroll in the FAME program myself. I saved to purchase my first home in 2015, and I now find myself serving as the statewide FAME director as part of my role at West Central. Since the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota program started 20 years ago, FAME match dollars have been provided half through a state appropriation and half with federal grants through the Federal Assets for Independence Act. Unfortunately, the federal funding was eliminated in 2017, as Representative Moran stated. The final federal grant funds were exhausted last year, and new enrollment in the FAME program has been paused. State statute requires a secondary match in order for state funds to be used. So currently $270,000 of the last state appropriation is sitting in a FAME account, unable to be used because we can't meet the match requirement without the federal funding. In the next budget cycle, we may ask the legislator for a larger state appropriation to make up for the loss of federal funding. This year, we're just asking to amend state statute to eliminate the secondary match requirement so that we can use the state dollars that have already been appropriated for the full 3-to-1 match. Additionally, the Minnesota FAME Council has long wanted to add a personal vehicle as a fourth allowable asset for a FAME investment, but federal funding limited FAME investments to the three assets of home purchase, going to school and starting a small business. Since we're no longer bound by the federal funding rules, this bill also adds a vehicle approved by the fiduciary organization as an allowable asset. FAME is delivered by a statewide collaborative of over 20 agencies, led by West Central Community Action as the fiscal agent, and a FAME Council made up of collaborative partners provides oversight and monitoring of the program activities. The FAME program exists to help working families in Minnesota build assets and long-term economic self-sufficiency. Account holders place savings monthly into their accounts, which are currently matched 3-to-1. To be eligible for FAME, the adjusted gross income of the household must be at equal to or less than 200% of the federal poverty guideline. Throughout their enrollment, participants complete financial education classes as well as asset-specific training to help them prepare for owning a home, completing their degree, or starting their business. Program evaluation has shown that FAME participants walk away from the program with increased credit scores and net worth and decreased reliance on state programs. The FAME program creates a habit of regular savings that benefits the families for years to come. FAME stimulates economic self-sufficiency and facilitates increased community stabilization by helping account holders focus on short and long-term financial skills while encouraging savings and asset development. FAME empowers individuals and strengthens the economic base of Minnesota communities. Thank you for your time. Becky Johnson is here. She's a FAME graduate, and she's going to tell you how FAME helped her family.
Thank you for your testimony. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Becky Johnson. I'd like to start by thanking you for having me here today to come and share my story about the FAME program and how it impacted my family. Several years ago, I was a young single mom with a preschool age son. I was going to college full time and working two part-time jobs and still barely able to make ends meet. As a student studying social work and sociology, I understood that growing up in poverty meant that my son would face additional barriers throughout his life, and I wanted to provide a life for him that was rich in opportunity. I was fortunate to get my son enrolled in the Head Start program at Lakes and Prairies Community Action in Moorhead, Minnesota. In that program, my son received academic support for kindergarten readiness, and I received support from the staff in setting and working towards goals towards self-sufficiency. When I identified that I had long-term goals of owning a home and going to graduate school, the staff connected me with another program at Lakes and Prairies called FAME. At my intake, I kept thinking that this sounded too good to be true. The FAME program provided me with financial education and coaching support to help keep me focused on achieving my goals. One truly amazing quality of the FAME program is that it's very low barrier. There are no hoops to jump through and no overly complicated rules for participating. That was a huge factor for me with how chaotic and hectic my life was at that point. Most importantly, the program provided hope that I could see my dreams come to fruition. When your financial situation is so bleak, it's easy to feel like there's no hope for a different life or a different path forward. Having the FAME coaching support and watching my savings grow quickly with the match motivated me to keep pressing on when it felt impossible. When I met my savings goal, I decided to focus on education and used my FAME funds for graduate school to pay for textbooks and tuition. Now, 15 years later, I'm a program director at that same agency that helped me in so many life-changing ways. I've worked for Lakes and Prairies Community Action for 12 years, and obtaining my master's degree helped me move up the professional ladder to a director level. The FAME program is one of the programs that I oversee in my division, and I am blessed to be able to continue to see this program change lives in low-income people in our community. The financial boost of matching savings and the support in providing financial education and coaching provides families a chance to obtain assets that will set them up for long-term success. For a fairly small financial investment, this FAME program opened doors for me, provided me a solid foundation of financial skills, and helped me move forward towards a future of providing for my family and being self-sufficient.
Thank you both very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3632? Anyone else who wishes to testify? Is there discussion from the committee? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Moran, for bringing this bill. I've long thought this was a really great idea, but I do have a question about the bill itself, though. So in the bill, in several places, it talks about $3 from state grant or TANF funds. And I realize that the underlying language had the TANF funds in it too, but just curious about, I don't think I've seen that before, that it's an option to have it come from state grant or TANF and TANF funds. I don't know exactly what that means. And I have to say, I'm very protective of TANF funds. I think we, over the years, have used them for far too many things other than TANF, other than MFIP, cash payments. And last year, as you know, we finally raised the cash payment $100 a month after 30-some-odd years of no raises. So anyway, I realize this is not the Finance Committee, but could you just explain why the TANF fund, why this language is in there like that for the funding?
Chair Moran or someone else like to
bring in someone else to respond to that?
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Anna Odegaard, and I'm the legislative advocate with the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, and I have been working with some of these, with our testifiers on this bill. Madam Chair, may I answer the question?
Please.
So the TANF language was already in the existing Minnesota state statute. I asked some folks who have been working with this program for many years, and apparently more than 15 years ago, there was one year where there was a shortfall and some TANF funds were used to supplement the state appropriation. It has not been done for over 15 years. The language still exists as allowable, but there's no intention at this point of using those TANF dollars. There's an existing base appropriation through HHS, and we're not proposing that we make any changes to the existing state appropriation.
Representative Liebman.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that explanation. That being the case, I really think we should take that out. You know, and I don't know how that, what the fiscal note looks like when you have that language in there either, but I, just personal preference, I think we have to stop using the TANF fund for things other than cash grants to families on MFIP.
Would you like to respond? Chair Moran.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. And I will agree with you, Chair Liebling, that we have over time just really used TANF dollars for other things besides intended purposes. And we have worked so hard to increase those dollars. So that may be, it's in current statute. So I don't know what that looks like, neither to remove it now, if that's another bill that we need to introduce, or I don't know if we can just wipe it out in this bill, you know, draw a line through it. But the underlying purposes, maybe another bill. I just don't know. But we can look into it. I will look into it.
Representative Liebling, would you recommend that we re-refer to HHS Finance?
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, I think that's where it's going. I just, no? Oh, there's no cost to it.
That's what you, okay. Madam Chair.
Well,
Chair Liebling, I think we're utilizing the dollars that are already been appropriated for the use of this program. We're just asking that we can do that without doing the match from the federal government, because that money is no longer available. So the dollars are there for this program.
Okay. So, you know, that being, I guess that being the case, I guess, I mean, I certainly would feel more comfortable if we took the TANF out, and if it's not coming from TANF anyway, I don't know, that's just superfluous language. I mean, I don't know, maybe, I don't know if fiscal staff needs to be consulted on that or not. I don't know if maybe one of our House research staff could comment on that.
Ms. Pinelli, can you help us? Madam Chair and members, I'm just quickly scanning through the language in the bill, and there are at least a couple of places where it's in, where the reference to TANF is in current law, and then there's a couple of places where it's in the new language that's being proposed. I'd be a little bit nervous about trying to do an oral amendment in committee, because I would worry that I wouldn't catch all of the references on the fly. Representative Kale.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I suggest that maybe we lay this bill over and then work on that detail, being we're going to be meeting twice more this week?
Chair Moran.
Madam Chair. I understand your concern, Chair Liebling, about the language of TANF dollars being in, being referenced in this bill, but I'm believing that, and maybe the House Research can help me with this, whether or not it had to be referenced, because that's the current law. But again, the dollars for this year specific program are there to be used and otherwise, it won't be used unless we just insert this amendment in that strikes out the federal dollar match.
Ms. Pinelli. Madam Chair and members, I think it's up to the legislature what fund we use to fund this program. I know currently I believe it's the general fund that the money is coming out of. So if the legislature chose to remove the TANF references, you could certainly do that. That's a choice that you can make. Chair Moran.
So I'm going to repeat what I think I heard, that if we remove, do an oral amendment, is that what we're requesting from you, Chair Liebling, an oral removal of the word TANF?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, you know, Ms. Pugnelli said she wasn't too comfortable. I don't want to, you know, accidentally do something to mess up the bill, but, you know, actually, I think that Representative Keel's suggestion might not be a terrible one if we could even just lay it over temporarily. I mean, we're not going to be done for today for a while, and maybe in the interim, while we're still meeting today, we could, you know, have some time to just maybe she could look carefully so that we don't do something unintended here. I mean, if she's shaking her head, just a little more time might be helpful, not to derail the bill in any way, because I know that's a concern, but just to take enough time so that we don't make a mistake doing something orally here on the fly.
Representative Albright.
Parliamentary inquiry. I'm just wondering if we're availing ourselves to an amendment in the inside of the rules of the road, if you will, if that's setting a precedent that I certainly understand and appreciate what is being talked about, but I, from a purely parliamentary procedure, I wonder if we're setting a precedent that either side could construe as an advantage later on down the road.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Madam Chair, I would certainly argue that this is a technical amendment. We've been told that the money's not coming out of this fund. This word TANF funds was put in here just because it already exists. And the point is for Ms. Pugnelli to have a little bit of time to make sure that it's just technical. So, you know, so that we're not doing anything other than making a technical change. And I think it's always up to the chair whether it's technical or not, whether it violates your 24-hour rule. But I would certainly think that this wouldn't be. It's not a substantive amendment, and it's just a matter of letting her be sure that it's not substantive before we do it.
Madam Chair, and we won't prolong this, but
Chair Moran.
I think what I also heard House Research said that over the last 15 years, it has come out of the general appropriations and not from TANF. So if the concern is that we may be using TANF money, I think I heard the researcher said is we're not using TANF dollars for this program. So the question for me is, in general, if it's laid over, what does that mean?
Ms. Pugnelli.
Madam Chair and members, after consulting with Mr. Berg, our fiscal analyst, he did confirm that the base funding that we're talking about does come from the general fund, and there is no TANF funding, so getting rid of those references would not have a cost.
So,
Madam Chair.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we get some clarification with these TANF funds? It was indicated earlier by one of the testifiers that that the TANF funds were only tapped into when the appropriation was completely maxed out. It sounds like that there were no more funds in the grant program, and then they tapped into the TANF funds. If one, is that understanding correct? And two, if I am understanding that correctly, then if this program is taken advantage of and the grant program is completely used, would the TANF funds automatically kick in to be used for any additional participants?
Ms. Pugnelli.
Madam Chair, my understanding with TANF funds is that they have to be appropriated by the legislature, so I don't think TANF funds could be used without an appropriation that was enacted by the legislature.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as precedent, and we've all, as we've sat around this table, offered technical amendments to our own bills and others, with respect to the 24-hour rule. So technical or not, I think adherence to the rules would be something that we would want to abide by, particularly with notation with, as Ms. Pinelli has said, this is more than just moving or removing a comma or a word. We're talking about substantive changes, even though, and they are of a technical nature. So I think to Representative Keel's observation, laying it over temporarily in observance of the rules as well as getting it right the first time, I think would be appropriate going forward.
Madam Chair. Madam Chair.
Chair Moran.
So I would like to bring us back. I want to bring us back a little bit. Ms. Pinelli stated that over the last 15 years, money for the FAME program has come from the general fund. The language that you see currently in the bill is language that is in many other areas of the law, which they just utilize that same language because it is embedded in other places in the law. But for the purpose of the FAME program, dollars are coming from the general fund and has come from the general fund over the last 15. In saying that, I think there's no reason or purpose to be concerned about TANF dollars being utilized for this bill because only the legislature can appropriate TANF dollars for the uses of that. And we are not asking for that purpose to be done in this bill. We're only asking to utilize the dollars that are already there to be used without having the federal match. So for that reason and purpose, I believe it is okay to send this here bill to the general register.
Madam Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I'm fine with that. And you know what? We can always, when it goes to the general register, that doesn't mean it couldn't get a technical amendment there either if that was what we discovered in the meantime. So I'm fine with it, Madam Chair. Let's just, seeing as Representative Albright thinks it's a bigger deal than I think it is, rather than, you know, the bill, underlying bill, is very important, and let's move it forward.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Moran, I'm on your side.
Okay.
So I'm not disagreeing with the value of the program. I am just trying to express my concerns about that we properly follow the process. Notwithstanding Representative Liebling's observations about TANF or otherwise, that's not my beef here. I'm just wanting to make sure that we are upholding the integrity of the process that we all adhere to in the rules.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, I appreciate that.
Last call for discussion. Okay, there being no further discussion, Chair Moran renews her motion that House File 3632 be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. The motion prevails. House File 3632 is recommended for placement on the General Register. Representative Mann. Representative Mann, I understand you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the bill and the amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I would like to move House File 3026 be recommended for placement in the General Register, and I would also like to move the DE1-2 author's amendment.
Representative Mann moves the DE1-2 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. The motion prevails. Representative Mann, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 3026 simply codifies current practices into law, so hopefully this will be significantly easier and simpler than the last bills. Right now it is in law that the Minnesota Care recipients continue to get coverage for their medical needs, even if they join a clinical trial for an investigational drug or treatment. We just want to make sure that the Medicaid population also has this protection. This is already current practice. We just want it in the books, and hence there's that's the reason there's no cost to this bill.
Thank you, Representative Mann. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3026? Is there discussion from the committee? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Mann, thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it's an important step forward, serving on the Rare Disease Council. This is in coordination with that, and I appreciate your efforts on behalf of the people that this will serve.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? There being no further discussion, Representative Mann renews her motion that House File 3026, as amended, be recommended for placement on the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. House File 3026, as amended, is recommended for placement on the General Register.
Representative Morrison, would you like to move your bill?
Madam Chair, I move that House File 3892 be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Services Finance Division, and I would also like to move the DE1 author's amendment.
And it's in your package, the DE1. So Representative Morrison moves the DE1 author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Morrison, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Thank you for allowing Representative Richardson and me to present House File 3892, which would extend postpartum health coverage for women from 60 days to 12 months postpartum. Few events are more tragic than the death of a woman during labor and delivery or in the postpartum period. The ripple effects in a family and a community are profound, lifelong, and generational. As a practicing OBGYN, I have been horrified by the increasing maternal mortality rates in the United States, while these rates have been in steady decline around the globe. The United States maternal mortality rate has increased from 7.2 deaths per 100,000 live births in 1987 to 18.4 deaths per 100,000 live births in 2018, and the data indicate that more than half of these deaths should have been preventable. And according to a recent CDC report, Black, American Indian, and Alaska Native women are 2 to 4 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. This issue deserves the full attention of America's healthcare providers and policymakers. Many pregnancy-related deaths occur postpartum, including beyond the initial few months after birth. CDC has found that 1 in 3 pregnancy-related deaths occurred between 1 week and 1 full year after birth. This figure does not include deaths related to suicide or overdose, which are also a leading causes of pregnancy-related deaths in a growing number of states. Federal statute covers a baby born to a mother on Medicaid through the first year of life. It seems obvious now that mother and baby should have the same coverage. Closing the critical gap in coverage during this vulnerable time can mean the difference between life and death for some women. This bill differs slightly from what like-minded advocates around the country are pushing. Our bill would move these mothers from Medicaid or medical assistance when they lose coverage at 60 days to Minnesota care through 12 months postpartum. It would also require the Department of Human Services to study methods on how best to ensure continuous health coverage for women and infants after the 60-day postpartum federal benefit ends. I'm grateful for Representative Richardson, who I think is going to be joining us, for partnering with me on this legislation. DHS is also here to answer technical questions, and I have some outstanding expert testifiers as well.
Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Erin Stevens. I'm also an OBGYN physician, and I'm a member of the Legislative Committee of the Minnesota Section of the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. I'm here today representing Minnesota ACOG in strong support of House File 3892. As it stands, Medicaid coverage for women who qualify solely for Medicaid based on their pregnancy discontinues at 60 days postpartum. While we recommend that patients return for a postpartum healthcare visit within that window, across the nation, only about 40% of women are able to attend that routine postpartum visit, holding true across demographics. Many factors likely impact this, including that one in four moms returns to work within 10 days postpartum. Even if all women could practically attend a visit within a few weeks after delivery, complications aren't limited to a 60-day deadline. This is a relatively arbitrary cutoff, and unfortunately, women's bodies haven't made an agreement to assume perfect health and wellness at that point. Chronic medical conditions and problems caused or exacerbated by pregnancy or delivery have no guarantee of resolution in this period. The United States is the only developed nation with a rising rate of maternal morbidity and mortality. These are not all catastrophic events occurring in the course of delivery like many people might imagine. About one-third of those, as Dr. Morrison stated, occur between 1 week and 1 year postpartum, and at least 60% of those are preventable. One of our Minnesota mothers who is at high risk for blood clots was able to have a healthy pregnancy and delivery due to the use of blood thinners. But when she was no longer able to afford her medication postpartum, she stopped using it and suffered a lethal blood clot. Another mother took her own life when she had no way of accessing much-needed mental health treatment for her immense struggle with postpartum depression. High blood pressure, bleeding, infection, domestic violence, substance abuse, diabetes, these issues all needlessly take or threaten the lives of mothers in our state every day. These problems don't care how many days postpartum have passed. Because we care deeply about ensuring positive outcomes for every woman in our state, ACOG supports extension of coverage without interruption to 12 months postpartum for women who are covered by Medicaid during their pregnancies. The American and Minnesota Medical Associations agree. We at Minnesota ACOG do not want to see women suffer and die needlessly in our state, and we are urging you to join us in support of House File 3892. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to have another testify? Oh, I'm sorry. Please, introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Sure. Greetings, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Helen Kim, and I'm a perinatal psychiatrist employed by Hennepin Healthcare System and based at Hennepin County Medical Center. I'm a perinatal psychiatrist, and I serve pregnant and postpartum women with mental illness and currently serve as the medical director of our mother-baby program and the new Red Leaf Center for Family Healing, which will open in January of 2021. Mothers need health insurance that extends beyond the 60 days after delivery. Prenatal and postpartum depression and mental illness affect at least 1 in 7 mothers in general, and as high as 1 in 4 mothers who are at higher risk due to poverty, limited support, disparities, and discrimination. The risk for postpartum depression, other mental health conditions, and drug and alcohol use extends throughout the first postpartum year and even beyond. Untreated mental illness and substance use in the first postpartum years can be life-limiting and life-threatening. Suicide is one of the leading causes of maternal death in the United States in the first postpartum year. We know from science also that there is a critical window for infant brain development during the first 1,000 days of life. During this time, young children require consistent and nurturing care. Untreated mental illness robs parents of the ability to provide that consistent care and can lead to lasting negative impact on the developing brains and bodies of babies and young children. According to a Mathematica study in 2019, the economic costs of untreated maternal mental illness are staggering, $14.2 billion for births in 2017, or an average of $32,000 for every mother-child pair affected but not treated due to lost productivity, increased healthcare costs from poor birth outcomes, and increased maternal health costs. The mission of the Red Leaf Center for Family Healing is to save and improve lives. We serve pregnant and postpartum mothers, fathers, and families through multi-generational mental health and parenting support. We aim to help families thrive, particularly those most impacted by disparities. Mothers enter our program in severe distress. Our clinical services and intervention focus on mental health and also supporting parenting capacity. We believe that helping women and their families access effective and affordable treatment for prenatal and postpartum mental illness and substance use disorders lessens the burden and cost to families and for our entire society. We have the opportunity to support generational well-being in Minnesota by ensuring that all mothers have access to health insurance throughout the first postpartum year.
Thank you so much for your testimony, Dr. Kim. Well, and for the record, I knew you was there. For some reason, I drifted and thought you had already spoken, so yeah. So I apologize.
So is there anyone from the audience who would like to testify on House File 3892? Okay. Representative Richardson, would you have anything you'd like to add?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry for being late. So I hope that I'm not repeating things that have already been said. But I just wanted to thank Representative Morrison for bringing this bill forward. I think it's an important step forward when we're thinking about the health disparities that we are seeing, particularly within the African-American community, where Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die during childbirth, and Black babies are twice as likely to die before their first birthday. I think this is an important step forward, but I also think that there's a lot more work to do, understanding that when you control for socioeconomic status and education, and even having insurance, we're still seeing disparities. So I know this bill will definitely be a help, and I'm looking forward to working to ensure that we're providing more comprehensive services as well. Thank you for the opportunity to share.
Well, thank you. And you and Representative Morrison, this is a really critical bill. So is there any discussion from committee members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one thing I just want to note, Dr. Kim is featured in the most amazing video that was played at our prenatal 3 policy forum. And Dr. Kim, I don't know if you still have access to that cartoon that you featured. If you could send that, and I will, if members will indulge me, it's about 4 minutes long, and it describes her work and some revelations that you've had in the course of it that I really want to share with folks. It's, you do incredible work, the Mother Baby Program, so I just want to thank you. I really encourage members to check it out when I send it and flood your inbox with that. My apologies. And I also just want to really highlight for what I really love about this is the highlighting the importance of the first year for children. I mean, I know we've got the angle on the mothers, you know, to think about what happens after day 60 and what would happen in a child's life when mom is not insured and if mom is struggling with everything she's struggling with. And we know the first 12 months are the most important 12 months. It's just most of us don't remember our first 12. Actually, none of us remember our first 12 months, and yet that was the most important 12 months of each of our lives. So I love this and would want to encourage us to continue, because the last thing that that a mom should have to worry about is her health in those critical early months. So thank you so much to both the authors of the bill and all the testifiers. Thanks.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Well, there being no further discussion, Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 3892. As amended, we recommend for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 3892, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Morrison. Okay, Representative Morrison, on House File 1400. Remember, we gave this bill an informational hearing in September where we took public testimony. There's an amendment to the bill, so we're going to limit testimony today to the content of that amendment, and then we will provide time for members' discussion and questions. Representative Morrison, if you could please move your bill and your amendments, and then we will have you explain the amendment to allow testimony on it before we vote on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 1400 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations. I would also like to move the A2 author's amendment.
Can you explain what the A2 amendment is?
I was going to give, Madam Chair, I was going to give some introductory remarks, and then my testifier, I think, was going to flesh that out more.
Okay, please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, House File 1400 establishes a spoken language healthcare interpreter registry to be administered by the Commissioner of Health. The bill is the result of years of ongoing stakeholder engagement efforts, including providers, health plans, patients, limited English proficient communities, clinicians, interpreting agencies, interpreter member organizations, and independent interpreters.
I'm committed to ensuring that all these stakeholders have their voices heard in the process. This legislation does not just impact interpreters. It also serves to protect the Medicaid recipient patients who do not speak English and rely solely on medical interpreters from the moment they check into the emergency room until they are discharged. These are some of the most vulnerable patient populations within our healthcare system and require our action as legislators to ensure that they have equitable access to care at the same quality that those of us who speak English as our native language are provided. We must take urgent action on this legislation. Every day we do not move forward with a verified registry system, we put those patients' lives at risk. This amended bill establishes three categories of interpreter competency, which represent the minimum standard within the field. Number one is CORE, which requires an examination in English on interpreter ethics, standards of practice, and basic medical terminology, or completion of 40 hours of medical interpreter training. Two, proficient, which is completion of 40 hours of medical interpreter training and demonstrated oral proficiency in English and the target language. And third is certified, national certification or equivalent for rare languages in healthcare interpreting. The bill features significant changes to language from previous versions of the bill brought before this committee. Stakeholders have made substantial strides in reaching agreement. It has bipartisan support in both the House and Senate, and it requires the formation of an advisory council with membership representing a broad group of stakeholders, including patient representatives, interpreters, providers, and metro and rural representation. It also calls for a public-private task force to identify ongoing scholarship funds for training and testing, and to oversee a MDH-DHS study and creating stratified reimbursement for interpreters based on training and competency. Establishment of procedures for receiving and investigating complaints about identified prohibited conduct and for imposing disciplinary or corrective action as needed. It also provides interpreters with due process protections against false complaints. It's important to note that registration is not mandatory. No interpreter is required to be on the current roster system in the state of Minnesota. This remains true for registry interpreters. House File 1400 only proposes that interpreters who provide services for Medicaid recipients demonstrate a basic understanding of medical terminology, standards of practice, and interpreter ethics, including adherence to HIPAA and patient privacy laws. These are standards that we already expect interpreters to know, but we as a state are failing to verify that that is the case for all Medicaid interpreters. And I'm joined by Anjali Cameron, the research director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, who has worked with stakeholders for several years to reach a compromise and assisted with drafting the bill language.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself to the committee, and you will be helping us with the A2 amendment. Okay, and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for considering the amended language before you today. For the record, my name is Anjali Cameron. I'm research director at the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, along with my colleague Rosa Talk, the executive director on the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. Our agencies have been working on addressing barriers experienced by our respective communities. The state agencies, we've been mandated by you, the legislature, to identify and advocate for the most pressing issues faced by the over 600,000 Minnesotans we collectively represent as agencies. Approximately one-third of this population is limited English proficient, or LEP. Given the extent to which language barriers impede the health access of our communities, it became apparent to our agencies that work needs to be done to create standardized minimum levels of training for interpreter services for LEP patients in Minnesota, and that we are being responsible with state Medicaid reimbursements for interpreter services. Within the last 2 years, Ms. Talk and I have spoken with hundreds of interpreters, presented at interpreter and health industry conferences throughout the state regarding this legislation, and collected additional feedback from LEP populations. Based on the responses of this feedback, we put together the language you see before you today, which was based initially on the 2015 Department of Health report to the legislature. The amendment language is the result of compromises between a broad spectrum of interpreters and patients for whom the current roster system is not working. So I'll briefly just outline some of the substantive language changes in the amendment. So on page 3, line 31, the change, a significant change to the core requirement is expanded, as Representative Morrison mentioned, to either taking the exam, the basic exam listed, or completing the 40 hours of training ensuring that all registered interpreters meet a minimum standard of knowledge. This 40-hour training is industry standardized. We believe that the majority, approximately 90% of interpreters, would meet the standards. So we want to make it as inclusive as possible and accessible for interpreters to be on the registry, but that they're also demonstrating that minimum standard of knowledge. So there's also a title change to the second category from trained, renamed to proficient, based on the new standards for that category. This better reflects the oral proficiency demonstration requirement for that category. On page 4, the amended language removes the basic testing requirements, since proficient interpreters will have the additional requirements that exceed the tested knowledge of the core interpreters. There's other clarifying language changes to provide more specific instructions to MDH without changing the meaning of the legislation. The other substantial change is on page 11. Language changes reflect the request of interpreters to keep registration fees at $50. That's the current amount for the roster system. Interpreters felt very strongly during our stakeholder engagement process that the money collected for the current roster system should be spent before assessing registration fee increases. And then there are many changes to the year to reflect the implementation of this bill in fiscal year 21 and the requirement of the Advisory Council to report back to this committee and other committees of relevant jurisdiction in January 2022 regarding their findings on fee rates and reimbursements for the interpreter registry. Between our two councils, we've held meetings and reached out to partner organizations, agencies, providers, and interpreters across Minnesota, including but not limited to St. Cloud, Marshall, Wilmer, Appleton, Rochester, the Faribault-Northfield area, and the Twin Cities. We have a diverse coalition of members with both public and private sector advocates who all see this legislation in its amended form as a necessary step in the right direction. Our agency continues to work with these stakeholders, the Department of Health, the Department of Human Services, and others to ensure that we make meaningful improvements in the quality of care provided to all communities in Minnesota, including our limited English proficient populations. I'm happy to answer any questions that committee members may have.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the A2 amendments? Are there any questions for members on the amendments? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Morrison renews her motion to adopt the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Is there any further discussion from the committee on House File 1400 as amended? There being no further discussion, Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 1400 as amended be recommended for a re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations. And on a side note, let me just say, I am so thankful. We've been working on this piece for a very long time, and I am so happy that the stakeholders have come together in some agreement as we move forward. So thank you for the work, the hard work. So all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 1400 as amended is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Government Operations.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Fisher on House File 4013. So members, we have two other bills after this bill, and if you can stay a little bit longer, we can get done without coming back this evening. We want to try that.
Five notes, Fisher.
Okay.
be it's a great bill. Vote for it.
So, Representative Fisher, I understand you have an A1 office amendment. Would you like to move your bill and the amendments?
Yes, Madam Chair. Chair Moran, I move that House File 4013 be recommended to re-referral to the Health and Human Services Finance Division, and I would also like to move the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the shape I would like it, please.
Okay. So the A1 amendment is in the wrong folder. Members, you can find it in the House File 3486 folder. Okay. All right, so Representative Fisher moves the A1 Authors Amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Fisher, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, I appreciate the opportunity to present the bill. This bill is a result of issues that had happened surfaced around Water Gremlin. It exposed a number of poles that are currently in our system. Water Gremlin was originally a company that had, about a year ago, had been recognized as violating the permit by exceeding it by 10 times, putting cancer-causing chemicals out there. One of the things that we found out that was kind of frustrating through the process is that there were other problems out there revolving around lead. We found out several months ago that they had also been releasing lead out onto their employees' clothes that were then dragged home. One of the frustrating things that we found out is that there was no clear authority for the Department of Health to take action. Process that occurred is there were so far 100 kids been tested, 24% of them had elevated levels of lead. And what was occurring is that the Ramsey County Health Department had noticed the issue quite a while ago, had worked with the company, but the company can only work in a voluntary situation. In other words, if the health department or either the county or the state asks a company who is contaminating a home or other place with lead, they can only ask them to take corrective action. They cannot order it. They don't have that authority. And so what happened is the company just paid lip service and continued to cause unsafe lead conditions that continued other children to become sick with lead after the original instances were out there because we lacked the authority to take action. And what this bill does is allows us to redefine how lead is out there, because we want to make sure that our children are out there, are protected from these kind of sources. And anytime anything comes up that is threatening our children, that we've got the clear authority for the agency to take action. This is something that we've worked with the Department of Health over the last few months to help bring together to make sure that we can close these loopholes. For the children that have been impacted, many of them are from communities of color, 80% of them are from communities of color. The frustrating thing we're in right now is we had situations where they have 350 employees. The lead issue in the cars, they had to clean over 350 cars to get the lead issue out of the cars. There are many homes that need to be cleaned up, and right now the company is fighting having to clean up the homes, and they're able to determine that in the homes there is no doubt that the lead contamination came from the company, and the company is fighting in court saying we don't have to clean it up. And what we're trying to do is correct that situation so that when we have these serious health conditions that we can have our agencies go in and make sure that our public is being protected. So I'll just leave it at that and take questions at this point.
Okay. Representative Fisher, I think you have a couple of testifiers.
They are here just for in case there's any technical questions.
Okay.
The agency has not have an official position on this because they don't have the governor's package coming out. This does have a fiscal note, and that's why it's going to Health and Human Services Finance. But because there was a policy implication, we have a number of other things that are happening. We want to make sure to get this moving through the process so that we weren't getting all jammed up on deadline week.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 4013? Is there any discussion from members? Seeing none. Representative Fisher renews his motion that House File 4013, as amended, be recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Committee Division. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 4013, as amended, is recommended for re-referral to the Health and Human Service Finance Division. Thank you. Okay, Representative Jordan. We've moved to House File 3486. Welcome to the committee, Representative Jordan. Did anyone tell you about goodies?
Well, the bad news for this committee is that I've already presented a bill last Friday. So,
did you?
So this is, now I'm a pro, right?
Okay. All right, so the chair moves House File 3486 as recommended for placement on a general register. Representative Jordan, welcome to the committee again. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm excited to present House File 3486, which is a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead in their drinking water through lead service lines. Members, this is fundamentally a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead. No amount of exposure to lead is safe. Lead service lines are one of the largest sources of lead in Minnesota drinking water. And often, lead service lines are both publicly and privately owned. And so when replacing lead service lines, it's critical that we replace both parts at the same time to avoid increasing lead concentration in our drinking water. House File 3486 addresses the need to replace both parts of the lead service line by expanding the eligibility for the Drinking Water Revolving Fund beyond the publicly owned parts of the line and allowing cities to replace the entire line at the same time. This bill also cleans up existing language and addresses changes in the Drinking Water Revolving Fund to address disadvantaged non-municipal community water systems. This change allows these water systems that are common in manufactured home parks, senior living facilities, apartment complexes, and other living arrangements not served by a municipal water system to take advantage of grants to provide safe drinking water to residents. Above all, House File 3486 seeks to minimize Minnesotans' exposure to lead in our drinking water. Not only will this bill improve our quality of life, but a report by the Minnesota Department of Health and the University of Minnesota in 2018 found that for every $1 spent on addressing lead in our drinking water, we would see at least $2 in benefits from increased population IQ and lifetime productivity. And so remember, members, no amount of exposure to lead is safe, and this bill addresses the most common source of lead contact in Minnesota, drinking water. So thanks for listening. Some folks from MDH are here, and I can take questions at this time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony and for this bill. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 3486? Any discussion from committee members? There being no further discussion, the chair removes her motion that House File 3486 be recommended for placement on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails and House File 3486 is recommended for placement on the general register. We have one last bill, House File 4010, Representative Joyton. Would you, and the chair moves that House File 4010 be recommended for placement on the general register. Representative Joy, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good afternoon again, members of the committee. And I know that this is also the last bill of the day, so I will be brief. I'm here to present House File 4010, which is a very simple bill that will allow Minnesota to use the most recent and best possible science to protect all of us from exposure to carcinogens through our groundwater. Minnesota Department of Health sets health risk limits for groundwater, which determines health protective limits for concentration of chemicals and possible carcinogens in our groundwater supply. Currently, MDH must rely upon data from the federal EPA, so this means that MDH and the health and well-being of Minnesotans is reliant on data that's not always the most up-to-date or accurate. This bill will enable MDH to use other data and studies that have undergone scientific review. Often, information received from other sources and even other states is quicker to follow the most recent research and science. This bill also does not preclude MDH from using data from the EPA, but enables the commissioner to use the best possible information to protect Minnesotans' health and well-being. So in short, House File 4010 is more protective of Minnesota citizens and our groundwater. With that, happy to answer any questions you might have, and I know we also have some folks from MDH here.
Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on House File 4010? Any discussion from members? Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, you mentioned where this was going to be referred to already?
It's going to the general register.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, based upon the content, I'm surprised that it wouldn't have a stop in environment.
Is there anyone from the department who would like to respond to that?
And Madam Chair, while the testifier is making his way down here, the rationale for my observation is not that I disagree with the bill, Representative Jordan, but I do think that a proper vetting in front of the environmental finance department would certainly be in order, particularly with regard to some of the other issues that have been pertinent with regard to water quality and the like. So I think it's appropriate, because of the seriousness of the nature, that we should have a full vetting of it for that committee as well.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee, and could you introduce yourself for the record and maybe respond to the question?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tom Hogan. I'm the Environmental Health Division Director with the Minnesota Department of Health. So this language actually resides within the Groundwater Protection Act, where it designates the Department of Health to create health risk limits through that authority. So from a procedural process, I'm not exactly sure how to answer your question. That might be better answered by somebody else. But that's just kind of the status of why we're here in front of the Health Committee today.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Chair Moran. And while I appreciate it hearing here, I think you said two words that tipped me off to groundwater. And I think with regard to groundwater, relevant to whether or not the purview is through MDH or the environment, I think that it does rise to a point where more eyes on the subject would be appropriate. And so it doesn't have to be a long vetting per se, but I do think it's appropriate to my earlier comments about following proper process that the Environment Committee, because they do deal with groundwater, particularly with Chair Wagenius's concern about groundwater in all relevant nature and forms, I think that she would appreciate an opportunity to review it and sign off endorsing this as well.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I don't personally see a need for that. You know, the chapter of the Minnesota statute, the section of the Minnesota statutes that this deals with has the heading health risk limits. So this seems like the appropriate committee to me. It makes a very simple change. All the bill does is change the word and to the word or. I mean, I would think if Representative Chair Wagenius wants to hear it, she can certainly request it. And I imagine Representative Jordan would then send it there. But until there is such a request, I don't see a huge need to do that.
Madam Chair, could I respond to that comment?
We got a lot of
Madam Chair. One other point is that Chair Wagenius is chair of the Energy and Climate Committee, not chair of Natural Resources.
I misspoke, would be Chair Hansen, but the nature of the change here is from an and to an or. I think that's a very, very sizable, as we've often said, numbers can be changed every 2 years, but words are very, very sticky. And when we're talking about policy of this nature, changing from an and to an or certainly has wide-ranging implications, and I think Chair Hansen would certainly be pleased by our consideration and considered nature forwarding it to him as well, given his concerns about water quality.
Backer and then Keel.
Yeah, Chair, yeah, in regards, we had a comment that this deals with health and should stay in health. I've sat for many years on environmental committee, and well over 50% of that deals with health issues, groundwater, and all that relates to our health. So I would agree with Representative Albright. I think we should see this in environment, and because we deal with so much health-related issues. I know it's not the word health on it, but the environment is important to all of us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I will echo the same concerns, and I happen to know for a fact in my district that groundwater is affected by much more than just health. When we talk about irrigation or wells in general, we always, the Department of Natural Resources is part of that conversation, and always environment is around, and the public wants more conversation about it than just the quality of the water. And this is a huge change. I disagree with Representative Freiberg. This and to or to and is huge. And in rural Minnesota, this would be this would be questioned. They'd really have some concerns about this. And remember, we drill our own wells, so we drink that water. So
in hearing from folks, I think we have time to send it to another committee before deadline. Since there's no fiscal impact, maybe the Environment and Natural Resource and Policy will be Representative Purcell's committee. We can move it on to that committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So,
So in saying that, the chair would like to amend her motion to have House File 4810 refer to the Environment and Natural Resource Policy Committee. Okay. So we need to vote on the amended motion. So all in favor of the amended motion to send this bill to refer it to the Environment and Natural Resource Policy Committee, say aye.
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 All opposed? Okay. The motion has been moved and approved to Environment and Natural Resources and Policy. All in favor, say aye. We did that. I think it's time to go. Any further discussion on that? Okay. So, no further discussion. So the chair renews her motion that House File 4010 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Environment and Natural Resource Policy. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion has been moved. And we are adjourned. Thank you.
Madam Chair.